Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can also find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joseph Fink, President Emeritus of Dominican University in Northern California. I'm the past chairman of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and more importantly, this evening, your moderator for today's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you our special guest, Thomas Frank. Mr. Frank was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri, under the shadows of Boss Pendergrass and and Harry Truman. I almost said Tom. He's a graduate, has a BA from the University of Virginia and a PhD in American history from the University of Chicago. He also is the founder of Baffler Magazine, which he founded in 1988, and he edits till this day. He's the author of 5 books, all of them having to do with the cultural aspects of our times, The Conquest of Cool in 1997, which was about the advertising industry, One Market Under God in 2000, about the myths of the new economy, and a book entitled What's the Matter with Kansas? In 2004, which was about the red state mindset, and The Wrecking Crew in 2008, about conservative governance. He's also contributed to publications such as Harper's, the Wall Street Journal, The Nation, and a variety of other publications that you'll see constantly available. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Thomas Frank.
Well, thank you, Dr. Frank, for that very kind introduction. So, and it is an honor, by the way, to be here at the Commonwealth Club and stand at the very Lucite podium that Franklin Roosevelt stood at in 1932. So, what I'm here to talk to you tonight about is the confused era that we're living in today, a time when Americans rose up against imaginary threats and rallied to economic theories that they understood only in the gauziest sort of terms. I'm going to talk tonight about a country where fears of a radical takeover became epidemic, even though radicals themselves had long since ceased to play any role in the national life. A land where ideological nightmares conjured up by TV entertainers came to seem more vivid and more compelling than the contents of the news pages themselves. And that's my, jaundiced liberal perspective. If you think about it in another way, this is a miraculous time that we're living in. This is a period of another great awakening, as one pundit put it. It's a revival crusade in which the gospel is the old-time religion of the free market. We're living through the era of a grassroots rebellion and the incredible recovery of the conservative political movement from the gloomy depths of defeat. And yeah, let me confess that there is indeed something miraculous, something astonishing about this recovery. Consider the barest facts, okay? This is the 4th successful conservative uprising to happen in my lifetime. Each one of them, all a puff with populist bluster, each one standing slightly rightward of its predecessor, and each one helping to compose another chapter in the historical epic that I used to call the Great Backlash, and that others have called the Age of Reagan, or the Age of Greed, or the Conservative Ascendancy, or the Washington Consensus. These are all the different terms that historians use to apply to the last 40 years or so. But think about it this way. It has now been, as of this year, it's been 32 years since the supply-side revolution conquered Washington, D.C., and since the free market faith became the dogma of our country's ruling class, shared by large numbers of Democrats as well as Republicans. And since then, we have lived through decades of deregulation, deunionization, privatization, free trade agreements. I mean, the free market ideal has been projected into every corner of the nation's life. Universities try to put themselves on a market-based footing these days. So do hospitals. So do electric utilities. So do museums. And you know, so does the post office. So does the Central Intelligence Agency. Even so does the U.S. Army, even. And now, okay, after all of this has been going on for decades, we suddenly have a people's uprising demanding that we embrace the free market ideology, right? And this only a short time after that selfsame ideology led the world into the greatest economic catastrophe in memory. Yes, amazing is the right word for this. Unlikely would also be right. Preposterous would be even righter. Okay, so a little bit of recent history. In 2008, the country's financial system suffered an epic breakdown that was largely the result, as nearly every serious observer agrees, largely the result of the decades-long effort to roll back bank supervision and encourage financial experimentation. And the banks stumble, in turn, quickly plunged the nation and indeed the entire world into the worst recession since the 1930s. And yet, as I stand here tonight, the main political response to these events are a campaign to roll back regulation, to strip government employees of the right to organize, you know, out in Wisconsin and Indiana, and of course to clamp down on federal spending. So yeah, let us give these rebels their due. Let us acknowledge that the conservative comeback of the last couple of years is indeed something unique in the history of American social movements, a mass conversion to free market theory as a response to hard times. Okay? Before this present economic slump, I had never heard of a recession's victims developing a wholesale taste for Chicago school economics or a spontaneous hostility to the works of Franklin Roosevelt. Before this current recession, people who had been cheated by bankers almost never took that opportunity, took the occasion of their being cheated by those bankers to demand that those bankers be freed from the burden of red tape, right? And the scrutiny of the law. Before 2009, the man in the breadline did not customarily weep for the man lounging on his yacht. Now, the achievement of all this stuff is even more remarkable when we recall the prevailing opinion climate of 2008. And remember, after the disasters of the George W. Bush presidency had culminated in the catastrophe on Wall Street, the citizens of Beltway Consensus Land, which is where I live these days, in the land of consensus, all of these wise men agreed on the direction in which the nation was traveling. They had seen this movie before, and they knew how it was supposed to go. The plates were shifting. Conservatism's decades-long reign was at an end, and an era of liberal activism was at hand. This was supposed to be the unambiguous mandate of history itself, as unmistakable as the gigantic crowds that gathered to hear Barack Obama speak as he traveled the campaign trail. You could no more defy this plot line, they thought, than you could write checks on an empty bank account. And the thinking behind all this sort of wisdom and punditry was, you know, straightforward cause and effect stuff, right? The 2008 financial crisis had clearly discredited the conservative movement's signature economic ideas. Scandal and incompetence had wrecked the movement's ethical claims, and conservatism's taste for strident rhetoric was supposed to be repugnant to a new generation of post-partisan voters. Remember those guys? Besides, there was the, you know, the obvious historical analogy that you encountered everywhere you looked back in 2008. We had just been through a replay of the financial crisis of 1929, the pundits thought, and now the automatic left turn of 1932 was at hand, with the part of FDR played by the newly elected Barack Obama. Now, the pundits also had a series of recommendations for the Republican Party. The script went like this, they said. The Republicans had to moderate themselves or face a long period of irrelevance. So what the polite thinking world expected from the leaders of the right was repentance. They assumed that conservatives would be humbled by the disasters that had befallen their champion, George W. Bush, that Republicans would confess their errors and make haste for the political center, right? The world expected contrition. Now, what the world got, of course, was exactly the opposite, delivered on the point of a bayonet. Instead of complying with the new speed limit, the strategists of the right hit the gas. Instead of seeking accommodation, they went on a quest for ideological purity. Instead of elevating their remaining centrists to positions of power, they purged those guys. And instead of acknowledging that they had enjoyed their 30 years behind the wheel, they declared that what had really happened is what on earth is that noise? Is that the subway? Okay. So... I'm sorry, and I was just building up to like this awesome point. But rather than acknowledge that they had enjoyed 30 years behind the wheel, they declared that they had never really gotten their turn in the first place. The true believers had never actually been in charge. The conservative ascendancy, they said, that never really existed. And all the journalistic and historical work on the subject had been so much, you know, liberal propaganda. And therefore, and this is the most important part of all this, that the disastrous events of recent years cast no discredit on conservative ideas themselves. So the solution wasn't to reconsider deregulation. It was to double down and to work even more energetically for that laissez-faire utopia. Now look, the social patterns of hard times are supposed to be a simple thing, as impersonal and as mechanical as the forces that close down our factories and bid down the price of our stocks. Markets disintegrate, layoffs mount, foreclosures begin, and before you know it, the people themselves are out in the streets screaming for blood. The idols of our past suddenly become the targets of our derision. We demand that government do something about it, that they punish the perps, that they rescue the victims. We look for insurance against further catastrophe and for stricter supervision of the economy to make sure it never happens again. Or so it was, at least in the 1930s, the last time around. When the catastrophe comes, the Depression taught us, certain legislative deeds will follow automatically in its wake. Unemployment insurance will be extended again. There'll be massive investment in public works. Commissions will be named to investigate the causes of the crisis. Agencies will be set up to keep people from losing their houses to foreclosure. And as the economy falls apart, the assumption goes, we will also rediscover a certain, you know, neighborliness, a sense of community and even of collectivism that comes from our shared privation. And meanwhile, the people who are hurt by the downturn will start to take matters into their own hands. Union organizing and a wave of strikes will sweep the country in response to the complete breakdown of capitalism's promise. People will protest, of course, voicing their discontent in public places, like the striking farmers in Iowa in 1932. One of my favorite stories out of the 1930s, actually kind of a tragic and awful story. But these farmers who went on strike, they called themselves the Farm Holiday Association. And when reporters from the big cities would go out to interview them and ask them what they were doing, they would compare themselves to the Boston Tea Party, right? Because what they were forming these picket lines around the cities in Iowa, and when trucks would try to cross their picket lines, they would get on the trucks and dump everything overboard, just like they thought, just like the Boston Tea Party. And sure enough, in 2008 and 2009, it looked like the pattern was repeating itself. Our slump this time around began with this financial insanity that was very similar to that of the 1920s. And what's more, the bank's modern-day misbehavior began almost exactly. I mean, it's no coincidence that it began exactly as the old Depression-era banking rules were either repealed or allowed to go unenforced. And again, just as in the awful days of 1932, average people are rising up one more time in outrage, fuming against the money men who drove the nation into the ditch and the politicians who stuck by their cronies while the rest of us lost our shirts. And yes, 30s-style populism has made a kind of triumphant return, claiming to juxtapose decent, average Americans against an uncaring and predatory world. But should you happen to hear an homage to the spirit of the Boston Tea Party nowadays, the demands that follow will be exactly the opposite as those striking farmers in Iowa in 1932. What makes the rebels' blood boil nowadays is not the plight of their indebted neighbor, but the possibility that such losers, as they like to call them, might escape their predicament, that government might step in and do the very things those Iowa farmers wanted it to do 80 years ago, that seven lean years must follow seven fat years. Hell, that seems like a good deal to us nowadays. What burns our modern-day populists is that anyone has the arrogance to think that society might be arranged in any other way, that government might somehow allow our neighbor to evade his part of the common disaster, that some, mortgage remediation bill from Washington might let that rascal out of the hard times that he so clearly deserves. The people moved to protest nowadays are all liquidationists, as old Herbert Hoover used to call them. What they want the world to understand is, to quote the words I saw printed on a sign at the very first Tea Party protest in 2009, "Your mortgage is not my problem." It's an amazing reversal. How did conservatives pull this off? Well, for one thing, by learning the lessons of the Great Depression. During times of economic collapse, they figured out, nobody loves a defender of orthodoxy or a self-appointed spokesman for society's rightful rulers. And when the economic collapse of 08 and 09 came along, conservatism, the movement, immediately positioned itself as a protest movement for hard times, a social uprising with all of the sort of standard outward signifiers, people with placards, people protesting banks and big corporations, people yelling through bullhorns, people organizing boycotts. There were marches on Washington and big talk about strikes of the producer class. This is Speaker of the House John Boehner himself has said, that's why we're in this slump, is because the job creators of America are on strike. And what's more, the newest right even cast itself as a people's movement with no leaders, right? A movement that was so profoundly democratic, so virtuously rank and file, so extremely punk rock, that it was actively against leaders. A movement that was downright obsessed with betrayal, with, always worried about being sold out by traditional politicians, always trying to guard its authenticity. Now consider, in this connection, think about Glenn Beck. You remember Glenn Beck, the TV host who had his sort of very brief moment of fame, a shooting star across the American firmament. But for me, he was the emblematic figure of that public outrage in 2009 and 2010, and also the emblematic figure in all of the kind of confusion that I'm trying to describe here. Glenn Beck used to ritually claim to be a man beyond partisanship. For example, he's deliberately imitated Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington. And at one point, he suggested that he might have voted for Hillary Clinton had she won the Democratic nomination for the presidency. If you watch his TV show closely, and I've spent a lot of time doing this, okay? If you watch his TV show closely, or in the old days, I mean, he's off the air now, but you will find that Beck would sort of constantly pilfer left-wing imagery and arguments. He had this sort of critique of the public relations industry that seemed to come straight out of the pages of Noam Chomsky, for example. Or his famous charge of racism against President Obama, which was this sort of clumsy attempt to use a weapon that conservatives feel is always directed against they themselves. This newest right that I'm describing also glories to imagine themselves as victims. For example, there's this kind of entire hagiography of persecution that hovers like a halo around the person of Sarah Palin, right? That, this is her brand image. I mean, that's what Sarah Palin is about. When you turn on the TV and you see her face, you know that in just a second somebody's going to talk about that someone was mean to Sarah Palin. That's always what happens. This is what she does. I mean, there's a biography of her that came out a couple of years ago that's actually called The Persecution of Sarah Palin, right? I mean, the woman was running for the vice presidency of the United States by whining. And this fantasy of victimization sometimes becomes rather baroque. If you think about Glenn Beck's novel, his 2010 novel, The Overton Window, which is, truth be told, it's an exciting read. I kind of liked it. But if you read this novel, and like I say, it's a novel, it's fiction, but in this book, conservative activists are imagined to be the victims of everything that Big Brother can throw at them. They get tossed in jail on the flimsiest of charges. They endure these savage beatings by the cops. The book's hero gets waterboarded after he signs up for this sort of, you know, patriotic resistance movement. They have this, you know, this fictional version of the Tea Party, and their meetings are infiltrated by police spies and then broken up by these mysterious agent provocators who are, if anybody remembers the Red Squads back in the old day, that's the idea here, that's what city governments do now, is they break up meetings of Tea Party groups. And you find similar fears to this all the time in the larger conservative movement culture. In 2009, for example, the populist right was swept with this panic, this great fear that the new Democratic administration was preparing concentration camps for conservatives. Do you remember this? Now, upon investigation, this turned out to not be true. In fact, I looked into it and I discovered that neither federal nor state governments have ever mounted a campaign to criminalize the free market faith. But I also found that they have used force over the years to break up strikes, you know, imprison labor organizers, keep minorities from voting, and disrupt anti-war protests back in the Vietnam days. Today, though, it suits the resurgent right to imagine itself as the real victim of state persecution, which no doubt helps to enhance the movement's aura as this sort of dissident movement taking on a merciless establishment. Now, this is where I sip from the glass of water. We let the squad cars go by, you know, on their way to break up that Tea Party rally down the street. Okay, now I want to slightly change subjects now, because, look, it's a lot of fun to poke holes in the dumb things conservatives say. And Lord knows I have built a career out of doing this, right? I've written, three books on this subject now, and it's a blast. I mean, these guys, you know, it's a hoot. They blow off the facts when they feel like it. They swipe symbols from the other side. They illustrate their arguments on economics with fairy tales, and they really do this. I mean, the reasoning you hear on their favorite radio shows seems like something from a brainwashing session at Lubyanka prison, you know? It is preposterous. It is contemptible. But you know what it's better than? It is better than nothing. And I want to remember one more time before we go on, the original cataclysms whose memories today still poison are every political moment, the financial crisis and the bailouts. And I want you to remember that the culprits of those cataclysms, by which I mean the people who wrecked our economy, were not punished for what they did. They were rewarded And when I say this, I don't mean that they got away with a slap on the wrist. I mean they were laden down with billions and our blessings. And today they are rich in a way that you and I will never be able to understand. And all of this happened, remember, courtesy of our government, the officials of which have conducted themselves ever since as though nothing really untoward happened at all. The bailout money will be recouped, they tell us. Nothing to see here. Walk on by. The experts understand these things. Now, I tell you, you could not have contrived a scenario better calculated to destroy public faith in American institutions. I mean, what is the point of hard work, of scrapping for a few dollars more, some crappy hourly wage, when dishonest financial ledger demand is so profitable? Why play by the rules when they obviously don't apply to everyone? When louts and bullies and crooks take home society's greatest rewards. Look, the bailouts created a perfect situation for populism in the old Jacksonian tradition, for old-fashioned calamity howlers, like we used to call them in Kansas, for Jeremiah's raging against the corrupt and the powerful. And one of our two political factions in this country took to that task immediately and with relish. I mean, they tossed inconvenient leaders overboard. See it, George W. Bush, not a part of our movement anymore. They declared war on what they called the ruling class. They assembled with their megaphones out in the park and gave voice to the people's outrage. But the other faction, the actual political descendants of Jackson and Harry S. Truman and Franklin D. Roosevelt, did not seem to get it. They failed to rise to this occasion, to take this opportunity. They could not understand that the circumstances now called for something different. They could not embrace the requirements of the moment, even though responding to hard times was once their party's very reason for being. Take the bailouts again. Look, there were 100 different ways that that situation in 2008 could have been dealt with. And each one of those ways was less of an outrage than the way actually chosen by Bush and Hank Paulson. But upon taking office, what did Barack Obama do? He didn't break with Paulson's campaign. He didn't lay plans to reduce investment banking's power over American life like Franklin Roosevelt did. Instead, he took pains to let the world know that he embraced the Paulson strategy. And each time, or almost each time, that political adversity came in the following years, the Obama team compromised in the direction of Wall Street, as though that was who needed to be mollified, as though that was the power that had to be assuaged. Now look, the folly of this strategy in economic terms, and in terms to each of us as economic actors and people that hope to, you know, earn a living by our hard work, the folly of this stuff should be obvious to every single one of us by now. That it might also lead to electoral disaster probably never even occurred to the president's, you know, tough guy political advisors. I mean, after all, catering to Wall Street had brought only victories to Bill Clinton. Coming around to the way of the market had been regarded as high-minded stuff back in the 1990s, this sort of statesmanlike acknowledgement of the obvious validity of conservative economic ideas. And when I say obvious, you know what I mean. You remember that Time magazine cover in 1999? The Committee to Save the World, Robert Rubin, Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers. Everyone agreed. The free market way was beyond ideology. Every thinking person accepted this. It was just obvious. But look, the advent of hard times made all of that sort of reasoning as obsolete as the floppy disk. Although Democrats in Washington apparently never got it, the Great Recession had repolarized the compass points. Nothing worked the way it used to back in the 1990s. It was no longer about left versus right in the conventional Washington sense. It was about special interests versus common interests. This was the moment for a second FDR, not Clinton II. God, you know, I told you I live in Washington these days. And sometimes when I watch the Washington Democrats in action. My mind goes back to the tragically incompetent British general staff of World War I, you know, ordering assault after gigantic assault. You know, a million men at the Somme, a million men at Ypres, a million men at Passchendaele, only to see these armies annihilated one after another. But still they kept at it, ordering up another round of the exact same goddamn thing, playing by the gentlemanly rules of combat, never doing anything remotely clever, and always completely surprised when the other side introduced them to 20th century warfare in some brutal new way. And sometimes I wonder what things will look like when the new revitalized right actually gets the chance to do what they say they want to do with our country. I mean, maybe the pundits will finally be proven right then, and the rightward drift of the last 40 years will stop all of its own accord. Right? Some invisible hand of history will reach out and make everything go back in the other direction. The nation will finally reverse course and everything will be fine and all the centrist sort of, you know, mechanical thinking will be proven correct. Or maybe, as the nation clambers further down into the sulfurous pit that our market-minded friends call utopia, the thinking of the conservative movement will continue to evolve. And before long, they will have discovered that certain once uncontroversial arms of the state must be amputated immediately. What are interstate highways and national parks, they'll ask, but wasteful subsidies for leeches who ought to be paying their own way? What is disaster relief but a power grab by losers who can't get themselves out of the path of a hurricane or an earthquake? You know Social Security will have to go, of course, as the essential injustice of protecting the weak dawns on us all. I mean, why should society pay for the retirement of someone who hasn't been all responsible and listened to those AM radio announcers and collected Krugerrands like everyone knows they're supposed to do? And you know that every problem the editorialists fret about today will just get worse. Inequality, global warming, financial bubbles, one after another after another. But it will not matter. On America will go, chasing the only ideology that the country has left, down into the seething Arcadia of all against all. Thank you very much for coming.
Our thanks to Thomas Frank, the author of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. We have a number of questions, Mr. Frank, that have come from the audience, and so let's get started.
All right.
What's your take on the Occupy Wall Street movement? How will it impact the discussions that are going on as far as the parties are concerned as we move toward the presidential election? Are they the current version of those farmers you were talking about in Iowa?
Well, in some ways, yeah, because it's the timing is right, right? It's 3 years after the financial crisis that Occupy Wall Street shows up. That's the standard delay that we know of from the 1930s. But and look, I'm very hopeful about Occupy Wall Street. I'm putting aside like the guys, the protesters who want to pick a fight with police or set fire to things or something like that. You know, obviously I don't approve of that. But by and large, it's a powerful thing, and it's something that had to happen. And when I saw the, you know, I am the 99% campaign on the internet, this is overwhelming. It was so eloquent. It was extremely powerful. And it has already changed the debate in this country. And I'll give you an example from my personal history. When I wrote One Market Under God many years ago, and I think I came and spoke here at the Commonwealth Club about it. It was 10 years ago. Oh, more than 10. Jeez, what decade are we in? Anyhow, the central sort of data point in One Market Under God was the concentration of wealth. You know, CEOs earning 400 times what their average employees did or something like that. And this was regarded as unacceptable to point out at the time. This was not an acceptable subject of political conversation. And Today it is. Even the president is talking about it. Even the Republicans are talking about it. And we have Occupy Wall Street to thank for that. And I look, I'll bring this up again as we go on, hopefully. But there's two things to remember. First of all, Occupy Wall Street and its predecessor, which is the what was going on in Wisconsin when all the protests against Scott Walker, where you first saw all of these sort of symbols being used, when they were occupying the Capitol building in Madison, that both of these protests are a cry of desperation. That's what they are. I mean, those people in Wisconsin are looking at the end of their way of life. And that's why they're out there in such enormous numbers, and that's why so many people signed those petitions to recall Governor Walker. And that's the same with the I am the 99% thing. This is a cry of desperation. This is people with their backs to the wall. And that is powerful, but it's also a starting point. Okay, this movement needs to grow and it needs to become relevant to every single person in this country. Where in the same way that you had social movements in the 1930s doing that. Now, and here's the important point, and I'm sure I'm going to anticipate a bunch of your questions this way. I'm sick of being taken for granted by the Democrats in Washington, and of course by the Republicans as well. Depending on which side you're on. Although that's an argument we'll have. We'll bracket that the Republican side of that debate for some other time. But I'm the kind of voter that Barack Obama doesn't need to give a goddamn thing to, because he knows that I'm not going to vote for President Santorum, whatever it is, And that's no good. That as a political system, that doesn't serve anybody. I mean, we know who it serves. It serves the people that fund political campaigns, and they get what they want from both parties. They're well served, They get exactly what they want. I mean, to the letter, But the rest of us are left out. And the only way that we're going to move, the political party like the Democratic Party is with outside organizing, and that's what I hope that Occupy Wall Street turns out to be the beginning of.
Thank you. But can it really move forward without having a concrete agenda? That's the criticism we hear constantly. There's no concrete agenda coming out of Wall Street.
No, they will need that, and they'll need organization as well. I often think that it was started by the guys from Adbusters magazine. And it's funny, they started up about the same time as the Baffler magazine did, and with the same kind of very similar critique of consumer culture. It's really funny. That's the road not taken for us, I guess. I'm sorry. That went nowhere. All right, forget that. You want to hear a funny story?
Sure.
So this afternoon I was over at City Lights Bookstore, which is one of the truly great independent bookstores in this country, and it's right here in San Francisco. And I was standing in line, and the guy in front of me in line was trying to sell his zine. You know what a zine is? Trying to sell his zine to the guys who run City Lights Books, and that's exactly what I did in 1988. I traveled around the country selling my zine to independent bookstores, and City Lights was one of the bookstores that would carry it, and we used to go out there and do readings. God, those were the days. And a long time ago. Anyhow, I'm sorry. That has absolutely nothing to do with anything, but it's very poignant, It's a
You said that Barack Obama had compromised in the direction of Wall Street. If that's correct, why is there such hostility and disdain between or from Wall Street to the president?
Well, there's a lot of hostility and disdain from certain elements on Wall Street, and I think it's because they think they can get a better deal. I mean, they're screaming and crying because they know he'll pity the billionaire. What was the? One of these guys wrote him a letter complaining about class warfare and this kind of thing, but if you go back and look at who donated to President Obama's campaign in 2008, of course the financial industry is way up there. All your different Wall Street firms, and I'm sure we'll see that again this time around. I think they've been very well served by the Obama administration, particularly given what they should, by all rights, were expecting, which was a second Franklin Roosevelt. And by the way, we should talk about what the differences are between the Obama route and the Roosevelt way. It's very instructive if you want to.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so this is one of the most The really critical points for me while I was writing Pity the Billionaire was to try to understand bailouts, because this is the trump card for the Tea Party movement and for the conservative revival in general. This is the point where that they can point to, and there's no doubt about it. They say that is a government intervention in a huge way, and that's, you know, they call it socialism, the crony capitalism, whatever you want to call it. That is their trump card. So whenever you're having a conversation with them, they play that card. That's the We were against the bailouts. At least we were against that. And everybody knows that the bailouts were an outrage. I was outraged by them. It was loathsome. It was disgusting. And these guys were against it. Fine. So I'm sort of puzzled by this, you know, about what to say, what to think about this whole situation. So of course I start reading up on the history of bailouts. That's the way I always do these things. And it turns out that bailouts have a long history in this country. And bailouts have in fact been done by conservative, free market believers many times. Ronald Reagan bailed out Continental Illinois. Herbert Hoover bailed out left and right. He was bailing with both hands. The head of Citibank, Walter Wriston, who is a character in One Market Under God, because he was one of the sort of great theorists of the cyber libertarian form of, you know, free market theory that you saw in the 1990s, took bailouts. You know, took the government's help whenever he could get it. And so I started researching the history of bailouts, and I was surprised to find that in the 1930s there were huge bailouts. Actually, if you take the dollars and adjust them over time, basically about as much as we did this time around, bank bailouts in the 1930s. And I was surprised to discover that, because no pundits mentioned this during the bailout debate in 2008. It was never mentioned. It was never brought up. And I looked into it a little more, and I discovered that Herbert Hoover, you know, started the big bank bailout program and was criticized in exactly the same way as we criticized, you know, Hank Paulson for bailing out his cronies at Goldman Sachs. The head of Hoover's bailout agency, it was a guy called Charles Dawes. He had been Calvin Coolidge's vice president. And at one point he quit. He was running the bailout agency. It was called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And at one point he quit and went back to Chicago, where he resumed his old job as the head of a big bank in Chicago, and he immediately demanded a bailout. And he got it, okay? And the public was just incensed. They could not believe that this happened, especially given that school teachers in Chicago hadn't been paid for like 2 years or something. It was this unbelievably offensive situation. And Franklin Roosevelt did not say, well, in the spirit of bipartisanship, I accept this, you know, the bailout program, and I'll just continue doing it, which is exactly what Barack Obama did. You know, he went and voted for the TARP, and he accepted the Paulson agenda, and he kept doing it in exactly the same way. You know, even put Tim Geithner in as his Treasury Secretary. Tim Geithner had been the point man on the Fed's bailout of AIG. Roosevelt didn't do that. Now, he kept the bailout agency, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but they did their job in a very different way under Roosevelt. When they would bail out a big bank, they would often fire the top management. Good idea, right? We never do that today. I mean, it's very rare. They fired the guys at AIG, but that was the Fed. As far as I can tell, the Obama administration hasn't done that at a single bank that they've bailed out. Sometimes when Roosevelt's bailout agency would go into a city and they thought that all the banks in that city were corrupt, they would start a new one. The federal government would go into a city and start a bank. They would bail out institutions from the bottom up. They would go to little mom and pop SNLs and bail them out and make them strong. And they had compensation caps on Wall Street executives, on anybody that took bailout money. And what they were aiming to do with all this, and then you combine that with they passed Glass-Steagall, they had the FDIC, they had the Securities Exchange Commission. What they were doing with all of these things is Wall Street was no longer going to be the planning, the guiding genius of our economy. Wall Street was no longer going to be in charge. And that is you talk about audacity. That's an amazing thing, and our government did that, and it was successful. We lived under that system for 50 years and did not have, up until they started deregulating in the late Carter era and the Reagan era, we did not have, you know, panics and runs on banks and have to bail out all the SNLs. It didn't happen because that system that they set up back then was so, you know, was strong. Now, like I say, the pundits in our day and age didn't know about this. They never referred to this history. As far as I can tell, it never came up, not once. But you think about all the different ways that Barack Obama could have reconstructed the economy. And he had, I mean, the public was behind him. Oh my God. At the beginning of 2009, those huge crowds on the, down in the National Mall, he could have done it. And instead, the idea is to just prop Wall Street back up, status quo ante, go back and do it again, fellas. And I wonder if we'll ever get a chance to do what Roosevelt did in the early 30s, if we'll ever get that chance again. It's depressing, but that's what we need to be talking about.
Thanks for those comments. We have a question that kind of follows up on that. Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman, won the 1948 election against Tom Dewey because he ran against Congress. And from his whistle-stop train tour, people would yell, "Give him hell, Harry." Barack Obama seems to be getting ready to run against Congress as well. Will we be hearing a lot of "Give him hell, Barack"?
Well, I hope so. That campaign, people in pundits love that campaign because it was this come from behind victory. And so every presidential candidate who's losing always talks about that campaign. But a while ago, for totally different reasons unconnected with this book, I went back and was reading a biography of Truman. And it wasn't just a campaign against Congress, it was also a profoundly populist campaign. I mean, we talk about class warfare nowadays, and we either alternately embrace it. Did you see Newt Gingrich's victory speech the other night where he's talking about elites? I mean, you can make a drinking game out of it. The number of times he mentions elites, he's against elites. He's elites, elites. The conservative movement had this favorite book in 2010 called The Ruling Class, by which they mean, people like me, I suppose, for people like Barack Obama, of course, class warfare is supposed to be off limits. Although he was pretty good about that the other night. He's certainly coming around to it. But you go back and look at Harry Truman in 1948, and it is denouncing the masters of Wall Street all the way to Election Day in that campaign. It was an extraordinary campaign that he ran. And yes, he ran against Congress because at the time it was briefly controlled by Republicans. But that was a great moment. And it's worthwhile to go back and look at that stuff. I'm a fan of Harry Truman. There's three restaurants that I used to go to in Kansas City that had Harry Truman shrines in them. if you're going to go to Kansas City anytime soon, come up and ask me later and I'll tell you what they were.
How much of the blame for the Democratic Party's failure of controlling the political agenda is due to President Obama, whether it's lack of leadership or lack of the ability to explain from this very articulate man?
And that's another paradox of our time. I think that Barack Obama, when he was on the campaign, he first came to prominence in 2004 when he gave that great speech at the Democratic Convention, and he said there was no red states and there was no blue states. We were the United States. And I thought, so what? That's just a cliche. He's just saying that because that's what political candidates say. And then in 2008, he talked about the grand bargain he wanted to have with the Republicans and how he, all the bipartisanship stuff. And again, I blew it off and didn't pay any attention. And I thought, it's just window dressing. That's what candidates say. Every candidate says that. And I've since then decided that I was wrong. And that stuff was actually is of the essence for Barack Obama. That's not decoration. That's who he is. He came to, the capital of a country. He was elected president of a country that had been basically laid waste by epic financial fraud. And he thought that the real problem in Washington was partisanship. Look, partisanship is stupid. Don't get me wrong. I live in D.C. and I can tell you all sorts of stories about how dumb it is. But that's not the real problem ahead of us. That's the real problem is Wall Street. The real problem is getting these guys under control. And he remained under that delusion for a very long time, even up until the debt ceiling showdown with the Republicans, where he wanted to achieve some kind of grand bargain, and he brought that term back again, the grand bargain that he wanted to win. Now, I don't want to be seen as picking on Barack Obama, because I also think Barack Obama is an extremely talented and highly intelligent man. This is a failing of the Democratic Party in general. This is really who they are. And we talk about, in the book, I talk a lot about conservatives and Republicans being in the grip of a free market ideology, and the Democrats are in the grip of an ideology as well, and it's the ideology of centrism. And I've written about this in all sorts of places. They really don't understand the kind of suffering that's going on in the country outside of Washington. Washington is the wealthiest city in America now. They've never really had a housing slump there. Things are just fine in Washington, D.C., and it's very easy to live in that town and really think that the problem with the world is partisanship, you know, because if we could just get together, my friends, you know, the guys on the other side of the boulevard from you where they're all Republicans and over here we're all Democrats, and we should have a block party and all be friends. And you know, it's all just a load of Santorum. They have another failing as well, but we'll go into that later. They have another very signal failing with the Democratic Party. The last third of the book is my take on what ails the Democrats, and that's a big part of it, is their obsession with centrism and with, you know, always compromising. And the conservatives, they know how to play this, by the way. They know how to game this. It's super duper simple. You just move the goalposts further to the right, you know? If the other guy says, I'm going to go, no matter what they do, I'm going to be halfway between them and my own base, it's like the other side, it's like game theory, right? It's like, duh, well, what do you do? Well, you move it over that. Tom DeLay actually talks about this in his memoirs. You know, Clinton said he was going to triangulate between their position, the position of his own followers and us. And so we're like, oh, then we'll start out with a position as far to the right as we can and make him drag us back. Duh. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world to figure out. And for some reason, all these great geniuses and hard-nosed, you know, strategists of the Democratic Party cannot figure this out.
To those of you in our radio listening audience who are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, our guest today is Thomas Frank, who's been speaking with us about his latest book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Mr. Frank, are the conservatives all the same, or are there distinctions between more establishment Republicans like Mitt Romney and social conservatives like your friend Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachmann?
Yes, there is, of course. And the main dividing line is, up until recently, was the sort of culture war issues and economic issues. But the things have changed just here in the last couple of years. When I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, you remember the main argument was that the culture wars had, in a way, had kind of obscured people's economic interests. And those, you know, fundamental economic questions were not being debated at all. And what's interesting is today it's the other way around, that the culture wars have really receded into the background, and it's the economic issues are what we talk about all the time. But that's not to say that we talk about them openly or in a straightforward way or even in an economic way. We talk about them in kind of a religious way or in a matter of faith. We talk about economic questions in these highly moral terms. And I've really enjoyed watching the economic debate among the conservative candidates, especially Ron Paul, who's a fascinating guy in all sorts of ways. But he has this vision of, remember how I referred to Herbert Hoover calling people liquidationists? And what he meant by that was Andrew Mellon was his Treasury Secretary in the early 30s. And Andrew Mellon said the answer to the Great Depression is to do nothing. Let everything collapse. Let everybody be liquidated, as he put it. Let the farmers go down. Let the shareholders go down. Let, you know, small business go down. Let everyone get ruined. And then the economy will bounce back later on. And that is largely that's the Ron Paul position. He even uses the word liquidate. You have to let it liquidate. He said this in the debate the other night that I was watching. And it's a fascinating position because it's highly moral, or moralistic, I should say. The idea that we've lived too high on the hog for too long. We've run up all this debt. And, of course, they always confuse private debt and government debt, you know. But we've run up all this debt. We've had a really good time. We've had a blast here in America. And now it's time to pay for it. You know, it's almost biblical. His son, Rand Paul, has this phrase that he likes to use, the day of judgment. The day of judgment is coming. And with these guys, you know, what's really funny is then they get into power in Congress in the debt ceiling debate, and I'll be damned if they didn't try to make the day of judgment actually come, you know, actually try to bring the ruination down on America. I'm sorry, I'm going too far for you, Dr. Okay. Fink. I can see that.
not at all. Let's talk about the Tea Party for a little bit. Do you believe that it's going to be able to continue to be a major force, or is it starting to lose its momentum within the Republican Party?
Well, I don't know if you're going to see the big demonstrations ever again. I went to a bunch of Tea Party demonstrations in writing this book, and also they would have conventions, and I would go to those. And these were not like really large rallies. These were not, you know, on the scale of the one in Madison, Wisconsin. They're much smaller than that. And I've always been pretty much convinced that the Tea Party movement was, it does exist and it is genuine and it has this sort of grassroots authenticity, but it's also, we think it's much bigger than it is because of the media megaphone that these guys have, you know, by which I mean Fox News. You know, it was amplified up and made to seem this, you know, extraordinarily large thing. I don't know if we'll ever see those rallies and protests again, but I do know that a lot of the leaders of the Tea Party movement, and of course they did after a while, they did have leaders, that those guys have all sort of become part of the political institutional life of this country, and they now, you know, issue, you know, whatever communiques on behalf of the Tea Party movement, you know, several every day or whatever it is, and they're now sort of permanent players on the political scene, and you know, the Tea Party makes proclamations all the time. You know, I get them on my, you know, my brand new iPhone, wherever that damn thing is. You know, so they I don't, you know, the Tea Party as such we may never see again, but yes, I mean, look at the four candidates who are running for the presidency right now. All four of them are mimicking Tea Party themes. Gingrich was there from the beginning, you know, at the first, his people were behind the very first Tea Party rally. Ron Paul, same deal. Mitt Romney is trying his damnedest to seem like a Tea Partier. And Rick Santorum has been involved for a long time.
Why can't Mitt Romney get above that 25-30% approval rating with Republicans in his debates and in his quest for the presidency?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, they're suspicious of him. And there's all sorts of reasons for that from his, I mean, the man does, when they, you know, they're denouncing elites and elite, you know, elitism. Here's this guy, you know, who looks like a million bucks, you know, he looks like a movie star and, you know, and making a $10,000 bet. You just think of all the wrong notes that he's struck, you know. And what's funny is when I saw him speak several years ago at a conservative conference, and he seemed really all together to me. He seemed like a very polished candidate. I didn't think he'd have any problem rolling over these guys. Can I tell you another funny anecdote? I'm sort of going to veer away from that to where I want to be, if that's okay with you. So a friend of mine who's a Romney supporter was watching Newt Gingrich's victory speech in South Carolina the other day, and my friend was really upset. Because Newt, you know, was the reason Newt won in South Carolina was those TV commercials. Have you all seen these TV commercials? The idea, well, it's denouncing Mitt Romney for his work at Bain Capital, calling him a vulture capitalist, talking about all the jobs that he shipped overseas and all the manufacturing facilities that they wrecked in, you know, and it could be drawn right out of Pity the Billionaire, because it's Newt has basically swiped all this stuff from the historical left. I mean, this commercial that he's running is, if it wasn't for this little fig leaf at the beginning where he says, "We all love capitalism, but..." If it wasn't for that, this is a TV commercial that is to the left of anything Democrats have done for a really long time, okay? And why should he not do that? You know, nobody else is using those, you know, that logic anymore. You know, certainly the Democrats aren't, you know? So why not? So my friend calls me up, and he's very upset that, you know, that Newt Gingrich does things like that and also claims to be bearing the mantle of Ronald Reagan. And he's like, how can he say that? Doesn't he understand that Mitt Romney is the, you know, the fruit of the Reagan revolution, you know? That if it had, you could not have things like Bain Capital and leveraged buyouts if not for Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan made all those glorious things possible. And he's like, how can Mitt be doing this? Or how can Newt be doing this to Mitt? And I'm like, he's doing it because he wants to win. You know, it's, you know, and he's using these leftist tropes and the leftist language and all the leftist imagery because, you know, the leftists aren't using it. You know, so why not? But anyhow.
Rick Santorum, who lost his last election in Pennsylvania for the United States Senate, is doing fairly well. He's been able to raise a great deal of money and is still a prominent candidate as we've moved toward the choices of the Republican Party. Doesn't that mean that those social issues that you're kind of dismissing to a degree, whether abortion or marriage or affirmative action or what have you, aren't they there just ready to pop out once the
Absolutely. They'll be back. There's no question about that. The culture wars will be back as soon as all this is over. I mean, as soon as the economy recovers and we're back to, you know, look at the 20s and the 30s. And the 20s was, you know, culture war heaven, you know. That was when fundamentalism swept the nation. That was when they fought over evolution. That was the era of prohibition, you know, the great national experiment in moral uplift. And then the 30s, people were like, what were we thinking? You know, and they just got rid of that stuff as fast as they could. You know, and you also had the kind of high-minded art of the 1920s, like Dada and this sort of thing. And then all those guys come home and want to write social realism and make the, by the way, someone took me on a tour of your city to this beautiful city that you live in today, and looking at WPA murals around the city, like the ones up at Coit Tower and the ones down at the beach. And they're gorgeous. But you compare that style to what was going on in the world of art 10 years before that, you know. And that gives you some idea of where we are today. But yes, that stuff will be back. No doubt about it. And by the way, funny thing about Rick Santorum, the Wall Street Journal had a really good interview with him about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, and the headline on it was "Supply Sider for the Common Man" or "Supply Sider for the Working Man." I loved that. It's like how this guy thinks he is like some kind of representative of blue collar America is just absolutely, you know. I mean, I know I've been writing about this for years, right? I've been writing about how these sort of conservative figures pretend to be, you know, representatives of the common man, but how this guy gets away with it, it's just like, that is beyond me, you know?
There are a host of questions that I've kind of boiled down into really just one simple one. Why are people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and the others like them, along with Fox News, so popular in this country?
You know, I think a lot of it, let's talk about Glenn, well, Rush Limbaugh is very talented, but I want to talk about Glenn Beck first. He's talented too. Glenn Beck is actually a very gifted guy in all sorts of ways, very intelligent. He writes novels, as we know, in addition to nonfiction books, and, you know, goes on an annual tour and does his radio show and used to do a TV show as well. I mean, an amazing kind of guy. Why does he succeed? And a part of it was that he really was willing, and this is Fox News generally, and the conservative movement generally, he was really willing to talk to the angry mood of 2009, 2010, when other people in the mass media were not. Okay, and this is a point that I try to focus on in Pity the Billionaire. There's a classic example of this, or classic illustration of it, I should say. There's a slogan that the right had back in the 1970s. Where they would say, organize discontent. And it's, again, something that they've stolen from the left. It sounds like something from the old IWW or something like that. Organize discontent. And that's what they've been doing ever since the 70s. And they're very good at it. They're very comfortable with discontent and with organizing discontent and bringing people together in a Tea Party movement and screaming about the end of the world. And Glenn Beck is very comfortable with it, talking about onrushing doom, you know, telling people or encouraging people to get angry. The Democrats and the, you know, liberals by and large, though, are not comfortable with discontent. You think about a guy like Barack Obama. He's very cool, very professorial. Discontent is like foreign to his nature. That's not who he is. That's not who the Democrats are anymore. It's supremely ironic that that's how their party became the great sort of national force that they once were, is by organizing discontent themselves. But they sure as hell can't do it today. I mean, what they're all about now, in addition to, we were talking about centrism earlier, is appealing to the authority of experts and expertise. And this is their other sort of great failing, if you ask me. So, well, the conservatives are out there organizing discontent. The Democrats and the liberals are always saying, well, let's be reasonable together. But the experts, pointing to the experts and saying, but the experts say that we should have, universal health care. And the experts say that the stimulus package should be, $500 billion instead of $200 billion or something like that. It's always an appeal to the experts.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we've reached our time in our program where we only have time for one last question, but I'm going to ask you three that have to be done quickly. Number one, is it true you were a Republican originally, and you, what made you change?
Yes, I was, and what made me change was two things, going to college and getting a job. Getting a job will do it to you.
Number two, Barack Obama was your state senator when you were living in Chicago, getting your degree. Could you tell, not the royal you, but could you tell that he was destined for greatness?
Oh, so everyone said things like that whenever he'd walk into a room. We all knew that he was a great man and was going places, as they say. He's super intelligent, and like can speak extemporaneously on virtually any subject and sound like he knows everything there is to know about it. He's amazing.
And lastly, the response to the State of the Union address was given by Governor Daniels of Indiana. Is it true you've been telling people he looks just like Calvin Coolidge?
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that one. I did not see his response. That would be pretty funny because the right really sort of longs for a kind of Calvin Coolidge character. They really admire Calvin Coolidge. I was wondering when they were all campaigning in Iowa, did any of them visit Herbert Hoover's grave in his boyhood home? And I called them up at the Hoover, museum, and no, not one of them.
Our thanks to Thomas Frank, author of Pity of the Billionaire. I'm Joseph Fink, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.